Okay, so start off some logistics, and yeah, I know we don't have as many people here as I expect, but okay. So the assignment after RLP, which I hope people are doing okay with, I think most people have made progress. It's not that hard. You see that the tool does the hard part, which you could do yourself, but why do it? So the next assignment is a fuzzing assignment, as I mentioned last time. So our target program is a program that re-indents C files. So it takes a C file and produces a version with different indention and other formatting. And this is a program that's from FreeBSD, from the FreeBSD distribution. I think it was originally written for like 2.3 or 2.4 BSD, like back in the 80s, 70s. So it's pretty old. FreeBSD has actually modified their version to use a mitigation called sandboxing, where basically when the program starts running, they make it so the OS won't let it do anything other than write its output. This is removed from the version you have just because that doesn't work on Linux. So the things you'll be finding aren't security holes only for that reason. And only because you wouldn't run this indention program, hopefully, as like a web service. But this is a good exercise to see, like, this is some example C code that someone wrote without thinking about buffer overflows, and it's like, I think it's over 1,000 lines. So you probably wouldn't want to read through it by hand and find them. And a fuzzing tool will quickly find crashes. It's quickly, so in my testing it took, you know, less than 15 minutes to find multiple different crashes. In the real world, when you have a fuzzing tool, you're probably going to run it for like at least hours on even a relatively small program. You know when you're done, basically, based on you can look at like test coverage metrics, you can run a coverage tool, which exists to figure out how much percentage of the program did I cover, or things like that, to figure out when you're done, but typically it's like at least hours, often days, that you'd actually run it, but I assume you don't have that sort of patience. So any questions about this assignment setup? Okay. So last time when we talked about testing tools and error detectors, list some other techniques that are good at getting rid of bugs in programs. And these are, like automatic testing, more proactive. They aren't about fixing the problem after it's already there. They're about solving the problem before we start. Before we give the software to a user, we want to actually get rid of security problems. So static analysis just means program analysis. What your compiler does when it gives you warnings. That's static analysis of a sort. But there are tools where we've tried to apply this to actually find real memory bugs. And it's not super successful, but it's a big area of research. And there's some commercial success with these tools in actually helping make more secure software. I'm also going to talk about this because I'm going to go into things that programming languages can do to improve. And these are very related because the sorts of things you can do by reading source code are very, in a program are very related to the sorts of things that a programming language can do to make your source code more obviously safe and to enforce rules that will make your source code safer from memory errors. So we saw symbolic execution, and you can think of symbolic execution as a kind of program analysis. But there are other kinds where you can avoid many of the problems of symbolic execution in exchange for not being sort of as amazing at being able to figure out everything that's going on in the program. So symbolic execution, we have all these paths to consider. There are simplifications we can make where we're going to lose precision where we can just focus on the things we care about and still be able to, you know, analyze very large programs without worrying about how do I solve this really weird system of equations? Or how do I deal with this library function and I don't know what it does? And the observation is that there are like really easy cases. So like if you see this program, you can easily do some program analysis which says there's a problem here. So this is an off by one error. Doesn't matter what's in dot dot dot, we're returning a value that's not in the array. And this is something compilers will often do, and it's a very simple analysis. You don't need to look at any if statements. And it might be the case that this return statement isn't reachable, but we don't really care because this is so obviously a bug in pretty much every case it's there that we don't care about that sort of false positive. And there are other similar cases we can worry about which are a little more realistic. So there are real tools which will just warn you that, hey, you're using string copy. Probably shouldn't be doing that. That's a simple thing to warn about, and it's pretty effective as far as if you, as a software developer, have bought into, I want to write secure software, and I'm going to spend some effort to do that. So you can just check for easy things like this. And we're going to look a little at some slightly harder cases. So these things you can think of sort of how to do it if you understood how to do parsing, which you could learn in the compilers class. But it's not much more than parsing the program to actually find these easy cases. So there's some more interesting things we might want to find. Like this. This is pretty easy to find, but it requires a little more thought. But this does seem like something that you could easily make a tool that checks for. And also, when you see this sort of pattern, you can be pretty confident that something is wrong in the program. That even if you don't understand what's going on in this dot, 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 this is a bug. Like, if you tell a software developer your program has a bug with this sort of pattern, they're never going to say, no, that's not really a bug, it's fine. No. Even if this code is unreachable, that they're going to consider that a problem. Then there's other easy cases. Sorry, I got a time size of int cut off here, which is the important part of this. So that's another thing you could figure out, but you need to do some more analysis because you need to see, oh, this size goes into there, and we're multiplying the size of the buffer times something, which we probably shouldn't be doing because the size of the buffer already includes the size of whatever's inside it. But this is the sort of thing that is relatively easy to find. And these sorts of errors have the advantage of being things that are patterns you can easily look for without actually understanding what's going on in any other part of the program. And this is sort of the common idea of lots of static analysis, is that they're not going to be perfectly correct. They're often going to make errors both where they're going to miss things. You're not going to, like they might be looking for use after free, they're not going to find every use after free. And sometimes they'll also report use after frees that are not possible. And this is generally considered fine in the real world. If you want to improve the quality of software, what you care about is how usable is the output. If the output's full of false positives, it's not useful. If it's full of false negatives, it's not useful. So many real tools that look for these bad patterns don't care about being what is called complete, which means no false positives, means you found everything for that issue in the program, like every possible use after free you proved is not there, and aren't sound, meaning there's no false negatives. No false positives means for sorry, no false positives. So if it's complete, then every use after for you found is a real thing. Like, it's not like dead code. It's not some condition in front of it, which can't be true. And it's sound in the sense that you're not going to say, that function's fine, but it actually has a use after free, but it's kind of subtle, like it requires a loop to work in a certain way, and that might be a complicated thing to figure out. So there are many real tools out there which try to do this sort of thing where they're looking for patterns, but they're not going to be perfect. Their focus is just on finding sort of the maximum number of bugs that the programmer can actually deal with. And by not being perfect in either of these ways, they'll get away from the sort of constraints that we have with symbolic execution, where we need to solve this really complex equation. We need to consider all these possible paths. We're going to relax those constraints when we do this sort of analysis, because we don't care that that's going to make us get some cases wrong. We're just going to try to do that in a way where we're not going to get too many cases wrong. Or at least the ones we get wrong are ones where the programmer is going to say, yeah, that's weird, and not care too much. So one way we can think of doing static analysis, I'm going to have a simple model here, and we're going to try to find use after free bugs. And one way to find use after free bugs is that we're going to have a model of the state of the pointer we care about. So in a real program, we do this for every single pointer. And we're going to keep track of only one bit of information for the pointer. Is it allocated or is it free at every point in the program? And we're going to ignore everything else in the program. The if statement conditions, not going to care. Just not going to look at them. And we're just going to assume all code is reachable. If there's code, we're going to assume you can get there. That's how we're going to be able to ignore if conditions. And this is going to make our analysis a lot easier than symbolic execution. So if there's like complex arithmetic, I don't need to do it, unlike in symbolic execution. This is also going to simplify the path explosion problem, and I'll show that in a bit. So everyone understand this model I want to have here? Yeah.
So if you had an if else statement, the first one is if free the object or else use the object, would it consider that?
Okay, so the question is, if we have the object in different states on different sides of an if else statement, how are we going to deal with that? So I'll show that. So we're going to handle all possible paths, but we're going to do it in a way where we can limit the number of possibilities that has us considering. And we're going to do that by taking advantage of the fact that we're ignoring everything but the state. So what we're going to look for is, can I get here in the same state? So here's a simple example which has exactly this problem that you mentioned. That we have some quux that's allocated here, and there's some complex condition under which we free it, and some complex condition under which we use it. And we'd like to look at this, and we'd like to trace through the code and keep track of what's the state of quux at each point in time. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start at A, and I have this dash because we haven't gone through all the paths. So I'm going to choose one path from A to start out. And I'm leaving it dashed to remind myself I have another one to consider. In this case, I'm considering we go to A and we go into the if statement. So in that case, we go to B, and quux is free. And one path is that we then leave this function, as far as we're concerned about quux being used. And that's okay. Another path is that we go to C. That's the next thing we run that's relevant. In that case, well, we got to C, and it's free, which means we have a use after free bug. So our static analysis tool that works this way, it's going to say, you might have a use after free bug because you can free quux here and use it here. And that would be the output we would give to the user. So as a programmer, you take that output and you say, well, okay, can this really happen? And you'd actually, as a programmer, look at these conditions and decide, does it make sense what this code is doing? And most likely this would be a bug because it's kind of weird to not do other things with that would free Quux in the correct way. So there seems to be some sort of bug here. So this makes sense so far? Yeah. A, sorry?
So it would never consider, a state in which B is not, never mind.
Okay, so the question is, what about skipping B? That's why, so I have A dash to remind me that I didn't consider all the cases, places we could go from A. Because that is a problem. So I've done, so I still need to finish the rest of A. So let's do that now. So there's another path we can take from A, which is that instead of going to B, we can end up at C without going to B. So in that case, we're going to get to C, and it's going to be allocated. And that's OK. In that case, we say we didn't find a bug. And you notice here that I've marked these nodes as A, B, and C from freed, and C from allocated. So when we're doing this analysis, all we need to consider about being at a particular location in the program is what was our state coming in and what point in the program are we at. So if we got to C and it's freed, that's the same in every case as far as what the rest of the analysis will do. We got to C and Quux was allocated, the result's going to be the same in every case. It doesn't matter what's beyond Quux. And that's because the only thing we care about is whether Quux we think is freed or allocated. So in this case, our static analysis can give a warning because there's probably a problem, but it's not a guarantee. So it could be the case that complex flu and complex bar are mutually exclusive. And we just never tracked anything about those things, so we have no way of knowing. So a more sophisticated static analysis tool, rather than just give this warning, might look at this path here, back to A, and do something like symbolic execution, but only on that path. Because that would be a next step if you want to reduce your false positive rate. But that's still way easier than doing full symbolic execution where you have to worry about all the possible paths. And, you know, sort of the symbolic execution you do is you just find any test case which hits this use after free bug after you know that it's on this path that there is one. So this was a simple example, and it doesn't illustrate sort of the power of this technique, because this is not actually bad for symbolic execution, relatively speaking. Beyond that, complex might be a problem. You see that that's likely a function we can't look into. So let's look at a harder case, something with a loop. And loops seem really bad for symbolic execution, because if we're worried about having lots and lots of paths, well, loops can have easily billions, right? And this is the sort of case where making some simplifications and not caring about the rest of the program state really helps us. So we're going to start the same way as before. So we're going to go from A to B, and at B, we're starting with, I say, B from allocated. So we got to B, and the thing was allocated, so what's going to happen next? And our first scenario to consider is, let's say we go from B into C where we free the variable. So in that case, we go to C, it's freed, and we go to D where it's freed. And then we have two places we could go, which is why I've dashed off D, and I've still dashed off B because we haven't considered a case. But one possibility is we just go straight through the function and we have a use after free bug. So that's the first case we can worry about. So we want to actually completely analyze this and see if there are any other cases where we have use after free bugs. So we want to consider these dashed lines and find other possibilities of where we can go. note that we could have not found the useActor free bug in our first pass. So we know that there's another place to go from B. We could say, what happens if we go from B to D? Well, then we get to D and it's still allocated. So that's still okay. And then we could maybe go to E, that's one possibility. And that would be okay, and we'd be done. And let's now finish up one of these D's. We'll start with the D from allocated, since that's the simple case. So I went from D to E. What's the other possibility? Yeah.
You go from D back to B.
Yeah, so D back to B. And that means we're going to want to go to something that's going to be labeled B from allocated. And we already have that up here. So we can just draw that line. And we don't actually need to do this analysis again, because we know everything about the state we care about is the same. So now we know we've proved what we care about for the loop without needing to actually do anything like figure out how many times the loop runs or anything like that. Yes? Yes, so we haven't finished this D from freed. Yes, so this D from freed can also go somewhere, and we'll need to figure that out. I have that dash to remind me that I haven't finished that yet. But I know I've actually finished this D, because now that we've gotten back there, we know we've explored everything from there, we're done. But there's no other case we're going to find that we don't have a simpler path for. So for D from freed, we're going to go to B, but the value is freed. And we don't have a B from freed yet, so we need to add one. And after we add the B from freed, we can go to C. That's one of the possibilities. And we'll find we have a double free bug. And similarly, we'll go from so that's one possibility, double freed, so we can terminate saying, not only do you have a useActor free bug in this function, you have a double free bug in this function, maybe. And we also have another possibility from B freed, we can go to D freed, which we already have up here. I drew the wrong line on my slide. We can go to that node. But we already have it, we're done, we don't need to consider any more cases with the loop. So any questions about this sort of general technique for abstracting the program? Yeah.
So for that C from free, double free, would you still have to go with that one to go to the D and then
the E? If you wanted to find bugs after the double free, yes. You'd still need to keep going. Would you go back to D from free, so.
Yeah, you would just look.
Yeah.
You'd
probably assume that the double free terminates the program and stop there. But yeah, otherwise you'd keep going if you didn't think that would happen. So notice that in this case that we found potential bugs, but we don't actually know that any of them are real. So it could be the case that some function is never true. Could be the case that complex function is never false, so the loop never terminates. And some function is only true once, so this code could be safe. But for something like useActor free, we are used to programmers writing in a style where you don't write code like this. We're used to having a specific place where you definitely free something, that's where you don't have code below it where you use it again. So we don't think that this is a normal thing to do. There are some cases where you'll have real code where you do that, which are a problem for these analyses. And what they'll need to do in that case is either you deal with false positives or you need to do more work. Yeah?
Is that where the programmer syntax you were saying earlier, something like the notes that you could work with it, that would come to use?
Yeah, so we have these hard cases. So our main strategy is we're imprecise. We just generalize. We assume that when we see a bug, it will follow this pattern. and that we don't need to worry about, is this code really reachable, or are these if statements correlated, things like that. But if we care about hard cases, one of the things that some of these tools do is they allow programmer annotations. So for example, for the analysis we're talking about, a possible annotation is, I promise this value is allocated here. Would be an example of annotation. Or you could give an annotation which is, I promise we don't enter this if statement if we didn't also enter this one, or something like that. But you could think of things that the programmer could tell you that would help you help the static analysis avoid some obvious false positive, which would usually be based on some sort of case where some path through the program doesn't actually happen. But that's not obvious. Well, especially not obvious to our static analysis because we didn't even consider any of those loop conditions or if conditions. So static analysis is a technique that people have started to use in industry. It started in research. It's still an active area of research. And its success rate varies. So it's good at finding some kinds of bugs. So array out of bounds bugs aren't really one of them. But use after free are the sort of bugs that it's particularly good at finding. Because if you assume that programmers usually don't write strange code for when they free and allocate things, you can think that many use after free bugs that are at least the simpler ones you can find this way, and it's more reliable than having a programmer look through the source code for that pattern. And they're really excellent if you know of some common way that people miswrite code that's a bug. So for example, this sort of bug pattern here, where you have a struct foo and allocate space for a struct bar, which happens in some software when like you change the software over time and forget to change all the uses of pointers and things like that. That's really easy for static analysis to find. And static analysis is not going to care that this dot 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 contains, you know, 1,000 lines. So if you can think of bug patterns like that, static analysis is a really powerful tool. And similarly to that, one of the big things that static analysis is actually used for is when you have an API, verifying that that API is used in a correct way. Because you can easily, like with use after free, you can do similar things like, did you call the setup function before you called a function that used it? So there are real static analysis tools out there. The biggest ones are probably CoverTree and Fortify, which are commercial tools that are expensive. And there's sort of different areas these tools are aimed. So CoverTree is sort of largely aimed at finding software defects and security problems, and being able to handle large code bases without problems. You have things like FindBugs is a tool that was originally written for an educational purpose. So it's meant to find bugs that beginners often make mostly. It also finds more interesting bugs, it's meant to find easy bugs. So it's more of those common bug patterns rather than looking for things like use after free and complicated software. And that gives you sort of a different amount of how much you care about false negatives versus false positives, and how much you care about making your messages really good versus making your analysis better. Probably the most successful static analysis is Microsoft's Static Driver Verifier. So back in the day, Microsoft had a real problem with Windows drivers crashing Windows. And one of the things they did to deal with this is they built a custom static analysis tool, which primarily checks not for memory safety, but for correct use of the Windows APIs within the driver. In particular, not doing things which might crash or various other dangerous things. And they require all people who release drivers for Windows and want them to be easily installed to use this tool and have their driver pass it without any errors. And it does that, the sort of analysis we showed, where it's an approximation. It doesn't like try to determine if all the loops and the drivers terminate and things like that. It's, you know, things like if there's some functions in the Windows API where you call one, then you need to call the other later. Make sure that happens. Things like memory allocation would be an example of functions of that sort. So these are a real tool that we can use to help us write secure software. But they certainly, you know, because they're generally, you know, approximations, they're not perfect. But just like fuzz testing, the way you actually measure these is sort of how many bugs can you actually find. And the commercial tools seem kind of moderately successful at that. So I say moderately successfully because, you know, they're not good at finding like really complicated bugs. Because, you know, they need things to be kind of close to the program. So I think qualitatively, it's likely that fuzz testing and static analysis find different kinds of bugs. There's also a big difference in that static analysis tools don't give you a test case. They're just going to say, oh, there's a use after free if you free here and use here. They're not going to tell you that that's possible. They don't know. And this is a problem for adoption of these tools. So I say on this slide that false positive rates are often 20%+ or more. So 20%+ is commercial state of the art. This is what CoverTree sells, is around 20%. Like, bad static analysis tools that aren't designed to work on your software package, it's not unheard of to have, like, you know, have like 98% of the things reported to be false positives. You know, if they're missing some common pattern in your software, that's a thing which will happen, right? And that's a real problem for adoption of these tools, and a challenge for people making these tools. It's not just, can you find some bugs? It's, can you find them in a way where humans don't have to sift through lots of reports to figure out if any of them are real? So any questions about static analysis in general? So part of the reason I brought up static analysis is it's a good lead-in to talking about fixing programming languages. If you think of what programming languages are doing when you have like types, that's a form of static analysis, basically. It's doing the same sort of thing where we take this approximate information through the program about like what type something has that's similar to is it allocated or free. We can think of encoding more things in program types and other sort of things that the compiler always deals with for us to help programmers avoid things like use after free bugs. Yeah. So the ideal of better programming languages is that we'll get better information from the programmer to help them follow a good practice and make sure that they're, you know, not disobeying a constraint like use after free. And that's the sort of constraint which it seems like we can encode with this approximate analysis without having our compiler understand like whether every loop terminates. It just needs to have something for our programmer to, you know, keep track of, is this variable in a possibly use state or a possibly free state. I'm going to talk about one specific example, which is Rust. And I'm talking about Rust because Rust has a system where if you use Rust in the way it's intended, you will write code which does not have use after free bugs. And the way this happens is you can think of that there are just safety rules you could use in any language which would keep you from having bugs of this sort. So we can think about it with array bounds. So if you wanted to avoid array bounds errors in C, you can follow these two rules. Always pass the array bounds with the size of an array, and always check the size. And if only our compiler made sure you did this and checked that you did it right, you wouldn't have any out-of-bounds errors. And we know that this is possible because like Java does this effectively. Like the only way you can pass an array around is with its size. The only way you can access it is by checking its size. So there are these rules that we can use. And then there's this problem that, you know, sometimes you don't want the overhead of checking, so you want to keep things low, and that's why people don't like these rules. So a fix for that is that we can have sort of selective mitigations. So in Java, for example, people who write high-performance Java, I have this slide, have an escape hatch. So Java has this, Java implementations, it's not officially part of Java, have this wonderful class called com.sun.unsafe, which, as you can guess from the name, they did not intend to be used as widely as it is. It has these wonderful functions. Allocate memory. Oh, sorry, that takes a long, I forgot about that. A size. And free memory, get an address, get the value of memory at an address. Put a value of memory at an address. These are Java functions in this special class. So in Java, if you don't want to use array bounds checking, you have this option unofficially. And programs do use this when they really care about performance. And you can think of what Rust is doing as having a philosophy that you're going to have some escape hatch like this that's maybe not convenient, but it's going to exist, so if you need the real performance, you can get it. But they'll otherwise try to have the lowest overhead abstractions they can have. And yeah, so ordinarily they're going to enforce rules, and maybe those rules don't give you as much flexibility. In some cases, maybe they're slower. Usually not, though. They're going to enforce rules to do that. So the Rust philosophy is basically that the default rules only allow safe things, but Rust is meant to be a language that can replace C, and unlike Java. So Java accidentally has this escape hatch because they used it to implement the JVM at some point, and it escaped, basically. And then people started using it in random Java libraries. But you know, Rust sort of has that more designed in, that there is an escape hatch when you need to do something funny. But ordinarily, you're not going to write code that way. You're not going to write code that uses the unsafe stuff in Rust. But that escape hatch is how we can implement new versions of the safe stuff for UUs if we don't think of all the rules that you want to follow. If we have something smarter than a bounds checked array, which we can still be sure is safe. We can implement that for you with this unsafe stuff, but have most of our code not have to worry about these memory safety violations. So for most of our code, we're going to have these default rules, which are going to avoid all the bad things which could happen. We're never going to have dangling pointers if you follow the default rules. And we're never going to have out-of-bounds accesses. But we're going to have this escape hatch for code where those rules, are going to prevent us from doing something right. So we can just do the one thing we need to do where we can't really show to the compiler that it avoids dangling pointers, even though it does. So we'll have an escape hatch to implement that. We'll only use that for a little bit of code, and we'll check that little bit of code very, very carefully, and not need to check our entire program very carefully for use after freebox. So this idea makes sense? Okay. So I'm going to start with some simple Rust syntax. So Rust is C-like. Functions are defined with fn. This function has no type. Functions can take parameters and output values. I32 is a 32-bit integer. Since Rust is trying to be a C-like language and is made with the hindsight of realizing that maybe variable size ints weren't a good idea, it has types named after their size. Rust also supports like C structs. slightly different syntax. I think it's still straightforward. Actually, this is not quite correct, but in a minor way. Also supports loops and variables. So it's very C-like in its general syntax. You may notice some weird things, like I had to say let mute. So let means define a variable, mute means it's mutable. The default is it's not. There's a reason for this, as we'll see later. There's some other things. And Rust also supports references, which are kind of similar to C references. But are they're similar to C pointers. So they're most closely analogous to pointers. So they support pointers, but we're going to avoid having dangling pointers ever. And that's going to be the challenge. Okay. And I guess something I should note when we're looking at this. So here's a sort of more fleshed out example, Rust, from all these sort of syntax examples. So here, some things that might be a little confusing, which will come up in my show code snippets, is here input is a variable where I didn't give its type. That's fine. Rust does lots of type inference because it's a modern programming language and does that. That's not relevant to security stuff, but happens. And that's why this, also why I say parse, and I didn't say what type of thing I want to parse, because Rust will infer what type it needs there. And there's this funny syntax here, here, which is, this is how I take a mutable reference to something. A pointer to something. By default, if I take a pointer to something, it's a pointer to an immutable thing. And when a pointer to a mutable thing, I need to explicitly say so. Okay. So with sort of that glaring syntax introduction out of the way, just to make sure I'm going to show examples in the future. They're not going to be completely foreign. I think it's basically C-like. You can mostly guess what's going on. Let's talk about how we're going to actually avoid dangling pointers. And the way we're going to do this, we're just going to have some simple rules to not have dangling pointers. Our rule is that objects are going to have an owner. And the owner is the only one who can modify the object. This is the simple first version of these rules. These will seem very bad right now, because how can you do anything? But this is the first version of the rules. Owner is the only one who can modify an object, but the owner can give away ownership. And the owner is the only one who can access the object, let's say. It's the simplest version. So we'll never have multiple references to an object. No way we can have dangling pointers. Problem solved. Just never have multiple references to anything, no dangling pointers. Probably can't write half your C programs, but got rid of all our dangling pointers. So Rust, at its baseline, enforces this with normal objects. So here I have a vector, like a C++ vector. And if I pass it to mySum here, that transfers ownership of the vector to mySum. So vector has a single owner, and the way I give it away is I transfer ownership. Which means that this is actually an error. If I compile this in Rust, it's going to say, oh, you called mySum with vector, that means you moved the value away from main. So you can't use it again. Yeah. So the question is there a way to return it? Yes. So here's one way is you can return back the object, which will move it back to main. So here we pass it. I'm doing two things at once in this example. Wow. Right. So I didn't mean to clone it. Okay. This is what I get for not checking my examples. You can return back ownership by returning it. So that's a way you can return ownership of the vector. So you can just return it normally. That's awkward, but you can do it. So if we didn't have this clone here, we'd just be letting this mySum borrow our vector for a little bit and then give it back to us. That makes sense? Yeah. Yes. Do I not have this example anymore? There we go. Okay. This is the example I meant to show. That's why I was confused. Okay, so here, this is the what I meant. This makes sense? So, yeah, so the function returns two values, we use two values, and this is one way it can give back the vector. Yeah. So the owner is there's one function, one segment of code that's authorized to access vector. So up until it's foo, up until foo passes it to my sub. At that point, foo is given away vector and can never use it again. And then when foo returns its vector, that becomes new vector in my sum. In foo, and foo can use new vector from then on. It transferred it back to them. So our rule here is that we have one that we're passing around effectively a reference, a pointer, this vector, a pointer to an array pointer, and we're just transferring it between functions. So when we're moving, what we're doing is we're copying the pointer to an array and its size, but not the values pointed to. And we need to transfer ownership because we want to avoid dangling pointers by following this rule that there's only one pointer to a thing at a time. Versus cloning, we'd actually be making a copy of it. So in Rust, for non-trivial types like vector, Rust will move them by default, meaning that when you pass them away, you don't get them back unless you actually get them back. For trivial types like int, it won't do that because it doesn't make any sense to not just copy it. So this is an example where my sum is borrowing the vector and then giving it back. So our ownership rules so far are that, you know, when you give away an object, you can't use it anymore until you're giving it back. And the reason we have no dangling pointers is that either you give away an object to a new owner or you deallocate it when you're done. There's no other circumstances under which we deallocate an object ever. So we have no dangling pointers, we have no use after free bugs following this discipline. The problem is that this discipline isn't very useful for writing real programs. Yeah. So Rust will do the deallocation automatically, yes. Because it has to track ownership, it needs to know when ownership ends, and it's going to insert deallocation if the ownership isn't transferred somewhere else. Yeah?
So on the previous slide, when the microphone returns total in vector, and who gets ownership of what?
Vector is returned and it's moved into the name new vector. And that's how foo gets ownership of it. So foo, as far as it knows, because the compiler works a function at a time, so it doesn't know that this is the same, this vector and new vector are the same thing.
Did it reuse the name vector?
I think so. I just didn't do it to not be confusing.
Okay.
But this is not actually how, people write Rust code, because this is a common idiom to just temporarily give away an object and get it back. That's probably our most common use of pointers in real C code, is that we give away an object to a function to have it modify it and expect it back for us to use more, and maybe pass to other functions. So Rust has support for this by having a more sophisticated version of these rules, that objects have a single owner still, and the owner can give away ownership permanently, moving the object away. Or the owner can let someone borrow the object. In which case, they just need to know when are they going to get the object back. And the common case is that they give the value to a function, and they're going to get it back when the function returns. And we have this other rule here, which I'll tell you why is necessary, that we can only modify the object when we have exactly one user, which is either an owner or the only one borrowing the object. Otherwise, we're not going to allow modifications. We might allow multiple people to borrow the object to read it, but not to write it. So Rust supports borrowing, which is how references in Rust work. So this is exactly the same as that sort of idea, but there's a much more convenient syntax. So I pass a reference to vector, and that borrows vector for the duration of this function call. So mySum gets temporary use of vector for the duration of it, and then we know it gives it back. And the Rust compiler will enforce that mySum isn't doing anything funny, like putting a reference to vector in some global variable. That's not going to be allowed. That it has to give it back, like just like transferring ownership at the end of the function, like it was doing explicitly previously. So that's going to be enforced by the compiler that it gives back ownership. It doesn't transfer ownership to somewhere else so that foo can't get it back. Yeah?
So it's, under the hood, it's still just using a pointer like we normally would see.
Yes, so, and this in fact uses, yeah, it's less copying because it uses a pointer to a vector. Yeah, so this is exactly like, so after compilation, this will generate basically the same code you'd expect in C for passing a reference to a standard vector in C++. So it's no overhead. This is not like array bounds checking. This is like no overhead after compilation. We're just enforcing the rule, but once we've enforced the rule, that's all we need to do. We don't need to do any enforcing at runtime. And so the key thing is that if we try to, say, you know, stuff the vector reference somewhere, that's not going to be allowed, because that's going to be trying to move it or let it be borrowed after the end of this function, and the compiler is just going to say, no, you can't do that. Okay. So we have this idea of giving away an object temporarily. So I've given this sort of intuition for how what the compiler is doing, that it's tracking that it stays within the function. This is the most complicated part of how Rust avoids use after free, is tracking what are known as lifetimes. So the Rust compiler tracks the lifetime of every reference, which is basically how long is the reference usable for. And it needs to track this because it needs to make sure you're not using a reference after its lifetime, and it needs to make sure that the lifetime doesn't exceed the amount of time that you're, you know, borrowing it from. And so the Rust compiler tracks lifetimes, which are basically from some part of a function to some other part of a function. That's the lifetime of a reference. So we have these rules for a lifetime that during the lifetime, the underlying object is borrowed, so we can't modify the underlying object during the lifetime of any reference to it. And we can't let the object go out of scope during the lifetime of any reference to it. And if we do, that's an error. And then if we have a function call, then the lifetime of the function, the arguments to the function, any references we pass, have to include the whole function call. We can't cheat there. And if we have references returned from a function, which is something we're going to allow because that's actually convenient, we have to know what their lifetime is. And we also have to worry about structs. So we're going to be able to store references in structs because a very powerful thing in C is storing pointers and structures. We want that to work. But we have to know what the lifetime of those is. We have to be able to show that it's longer than the struct. And this is how we're going to avoid dangling pointers through structs and other indirection like that. So most of the time, the way Rust works is you don't ever think about lifetimes. You just write code that follows this borrowing idea, and nothing bad happens, but that's not always the case. Maybe more than always the case. So one example tricky thing is, what if I'm returning a reference from a function? And here's an example where that's safe, probably. So here I have a vector of strings, and I'm just returning a reference to one of those strings. That should be perfectly safe. I'm not making a dangling pointer here. I just want to free that string. And that's something I should be able to do. And the Rust compiler will deal with this case correctly. And what it's going to say is, I'm going to assume that whatever lifetime I decide values has is the same lifetime whatever this function return has. Which is a pretty good assumption. So it's going to try to find some lifetime which works and compile the program. It gets confused if you have something like this. This is a compile time error, it just gives up. It wants you to tell it more about this function. What do you expect the lifetimes to be? So there's an explicit way of saying, annotating lifetimes, and saying, I expect this reference to live this long. And the way you do it is something like this. This syntax where you say, there's a lifetime A and a lifetime B, and this prefix has lifetime A, and these values have lifetime B, and that's the same lifetime as my return value. So this annotation, all we're basically saying, the important thing is that whatever the vector lifetime is the same lifetime as the reference I return. Sort of encoding the idea that I'm returning something based on that vector. And this is going to let, when we call this function somewhere, it's going to let the compiler figure out that's safe or not safe. So in this case, when we're calling this function, prefix is not safe to let be returned, right? It doesn't. This prefix has a lifetime which ends here. So it can't be the reference that get first returns. And we have to prove that the lifetime of the reference get first matching returns is something that can survive beyond get first. In particular, it better be the same as the lifetime of values. And this annotation lets us do exactly that. Yeah.
So why can't the getter matching infer
that item has the same lifetime as values? So the question is, why can't this be inferred by the compiler? So conceptually, it could. The main reason it's not is that the Rust compiler is just applying rules to function declarations. So you don't have to worry about your code breaking because you changed something within a function. But the function still should do the same thing. So the idea is that we can write just this function declaration and put that in like a header file and things will work, right? And we know what that function's signature is as far as what type of references we can pass to it. So the reason it's enforcing this rule is to provide that sort of modularity. And not you have you worry about what did the compiler infer from this function, which makes it safe to call or not. So it's being explicit so you know when you can actually call it. So it inferred it here, but the reason it inferred it is it just has a static rule that if there's an argument with that's a reference and exactly one thing returned that's a reference, they probably have the same lifetime. There's two possibilities. It doesn't decide. Yeah, so it doesn't have a good rule to decide. It doesn't know which one it should try to match. And an observation about lifetimes is that you can, for calling a function, you just need to get the minimum lifetime right. So it's not actually that hard to. So this doesn't give you any limitations when you assume they're the same, because you just choose a shorter lifetime than the real one of, or a longer lifetime of values than the one you could have possibly, or something like that. Not that bad. No, that's not actually completely wrong. Okay. But yeah, for this case, yeah, we just need to know which one to decide. right? We assume it's derived from one of these two values. We just need to know which one, yeah. What if it's not? Then you can have an annotation where you can have a C, yeah.
How does it know how long the lifetime is if you're just getting a common
case? You would have to tell it. So the common case where this would happen is that Rust has a notion of a static lifetime for things that are constants in the program. So that would be an example of a lifetime that would be another lifetime that you could get from anywhere. So that's our lifetime annotation. So by finding these lifetimes in our programs, you know, this is how we ensure that we're following our rules here, at least most of them. So I've missed the last one, which is how do we avoid modifying things except with exactly one user. So this is not obviously related to actually avoiding dangling pointers. So it seems like these other things, they make sense for avoiding dangling pointers because they ensure that when I'm letting someone use my value, that I know that they're not keeping it around for any longer than until I'm going to, longer than I'm keeping it. So I know that I'm not freeing it too soon. This last rule about when we modify the object doesn't seem related, but it unfortunately is a problem. So can someone think of an example of why we actually need this rule? Yeah.
Two people trying to change the same thing at the same time?
So concurrency is the biggest reason. So if we have concurrency, then that's going to be a big problem. Then someone could be modifying a pointer after and freeing it to reallocate it, let's say. And that would be a big problem because then we might be, because of that, two people trying to, one person grabbing the pointer, one person reallocating the pointer, someone might use the unreallocated pointer, which would be freed, and that would be a use after free bug. So that's one case. This even is a problem with a single thread. So let's say we're iterating over this vector here. This needs to be an error. And it's for the same reason. Even though we don't have conceptually two things at the same time, we're iterating over a vector while we're modifying it. And that's something we need to prohibit unless we're doing some extra coordination to make this work correctly. And the issue is that when we're iterating over the vector, we're going to do something like get a pointer to where the vector is and advance that pointer. And we want to generate the fastest possible code to do that. So we're just going to get a pointer, put it in a register. Then we're going to call this function that expands the vector. And now we've made that pointer invalid. And so to avoid situations like this, even without multiple threads, we have this rule against modification. That if we didn't have this rule, we need to be really careful about how we iterate over something, like whether we get an internal pointer and use it. But without this rule, we don't have to worry about those sorts of problems. We can treat them as sort of operations that happen continuously, where we get pointers to parts of objects and manipulate them and not worry about the object changing its layout from under us. So this problem makes sense? Yeah. Can't you still do this problem?
Yeah.
Yes, and sometimes it throws an exception, depending on the type of data structure. So usually when people think of making data structures, they sometimes design them so this explicitly works, usually not for something like an array list. And sometimes it's silently dangerous, sometimes it's not. I know in C++, this is often a defined behavior. The equivalent of this. So, what's running out of time? So we have these big rules to avoid pointers, and I assert that most programs can be written in a style where these make sense. That we have ways of getting references to parts of objects as long as we know who's responsible for eventually getting rid of it. And that person can give away the right to modify it and take it back and then exchange it. So we can write programs in this style. So it's pretty good. And this is sort of the main Rust philosophy. And it follows something that people already do in languages which aren't safe, like C++. If you think of common C++ code, usually it's organized in this way where it's obvious who's supposed to delete an object, and you're supposed to talk to them to get a copy of the object. So this is merely codifying those rules in the language and having the compiler keep track of when are you giving away an object and when are you getting it back. But you're going to say, well, you know, I don't think my program is that simple. So what are some cases where this strategy that Rust has of tracking owners and borrowing from owners doesn't work? Yeah. So recursion, meaning?
Like Fibonacci recursion, you have to pass it into each of you one. Would that be the number of them?
You can pass copies. Because that's not, that the copy has a new owner. But there are simple cases which are really bad for this. Yeah.
Does synchronized code work in it?
So Rust explicitly supports synchronized code, but there are other things that I haven't talked about to make that happen. Because that is a challenge. Yeah. There's some simpler things which are really problematic. Yeah. Yeah, so maybe you want to have a callback to some other thing, and you don't want to take owner, you don't want to borrow that other thing just to be able to call it back later. But with Rust, it seems like that's what you have to do. That seems pretty inconvenient. Any other sort of common patterns? Okay, so one I was expecting people to think of from this hint is doubly linked lists are like very hard. Very, very hard because the objects like own themselves. It sort of doesn't make sense. That doesn't really work. And so our solution to this is that, and we're still starting out, that we have an escape hatch that you can implement your own. And this is, in fact, how like VEC is implemented. VEC is not part of the compiler. It's implemented using this escape hatch. So what are some other rules we could use to avoid dangling pointers besides tracking ownership? Maybe ones which have higher runtime overhead than tracking ownership, but at least would guarantee correctness. Yeah. For preventing dangling pointers. Okay, so we could, so we could do garbage collection. Is there something? So we want to steal free pointers. I guess is the we want to steal access free pointers, and we want to still access the right thing guaranteed. It's hard to think of how to do that unless you never reuse addresses, which we could do. That would be one solution. We could always check, do we ever have an object allocated at this address and ever use an address? There's some simpler solutions that we could use to, you know, that are rules we could follow which have some runtime overhead. Yeah?
Maybe only having one delete or one delete owner.
So having one owner, one delete?
Yeah, like you can only delete it at a certain place.
So passing it back, so requiring us to pass it back to somewhere to delete it, but we have to make sure that everyone's passed it back.
Yeah.
Which I think we're implementing the same scheme. So So intuitively, how do you know, how, if you knew everything about a program, how would you know it was safe to delete an object? Yeah.
It's not referenced anywhere later.
It's not referenced anywhere.
Later.
Later.
So you have to delete, never see the name again.
Okay, sorry, okay, so you never see it again. Okay, so I'll give you an example of a rule very related to is not referenced anywhere later, which is called reference counting. So one rule is you just keep track of how many references are there right now to an object. Just a counter. And you delete when the count goes to zero, and you hope that there are no circular references. And if there are circular references, well, you're going to leak memory. So Rust implements this as an alternative. So if the existing rules for ownership don't work for some circumstance, and a good example would be that observer pattern, you can use this reference counting solution. So only for those observer pointers, which there aren't many of, where Rust can't prove that you aren't accessing things wrong, you can use this other thing which definitely prevents dangling pointers, but has a little bit of overhead. So in the sort of way that might look is that we could have a vector of, let's say, we have these grades that are shared between student and assignments, and they have a reference count, and we just add a clone of the reference counted pointer, which that's what the RC object is, to each one, and they both refer to the same thing. We don't have two copies of anything. And this is safe because this RC object will keep track of how many references there are to the underlying thing and delete when there's zero. And provided I didn't stuff an RC object in here that points to the original thing, we're fine. We also won't leak memory. So this makes sense, this basic concept here of counting references. So this is an alternate policy, and because we have this escape hatch in Rust, this is implemented just as a library that uses some functionality that, you know, is marked as unsafe. So there's a little bit of that you have to verify, does this really implement this policy correctly? But other than that, we have this alternate policy that because we're allowed to make something which looks like a reference but has a different name, we can implement. And Rust also supports a bunch of other policies. So when the default policy, which is mostly good enough of tracking ownership and letting someone borrow the object temporarily and then give it back at a known time doesn't work, you can use these more expensive things which do some runtime tracking. So one example is Rust has something called refcell, which implements the borrowing policy, but it doesn't check at compile time. It just checks at runtime, has it been borrowed or has it been given back? And it just fails at runtime if it's wrong. Crash, it fails rather than having a use after free bug. And it has weak, which is reference counting, but don't contribute to the count, but detect correctly if you access something with zero references. And just say, no, the object doesn't exist anymore, sorry. So by having these other rules, we have these safe interfaces, including the default ones and these other rules that advanced users implement. And that's how we ensure that people write safe code. So a majority of the code, you just need to be assured that those rules are correct and you know it's right. You also need to audit the implementation of RC and refcell, but that's going to be much, much smaller than the code you care about and probably easier to verify, since you don't need to say, does this have any use after free bugs? What you need to say is, does it follow the rules that it documents? And the default rules that are built into Rust are particularly interesting from a programming language perspective because those ownership tracking that Rust does by default without these things on top has no overhead at runtime. So in the common case, there's no overhead. But in the uncommon case where we need to do something extra to avoid dangling pointers, there is a bit of overhead. Yeah. It's not a whole lot. So it depends on how many references you have and things like that. That's the big question.
Yeah.
if you have tons of reference counted references, the overhead's going to be high. It's hard to say. It's usually comparable to garbage collection as far as overhead per pointer.
So does Rust actually get the same speeds as C
does? So it does, yeah. So does Rust get the same speeds as C does? The answer is basically yes. Especially yes if you write on safe code, because it compiles to the exact same stuff then. But yeah, essentially for almost all cases it does. So that's what I have for today. And I apologize for being disorganized at parts, because where did I put that slide? So next time we're going to talk about command injection bugs, which is a more traditional topic for this class, and won't have me gather haphazard slides. And probably web browser security after that, just depending on how much time we have. But if you have other topics you'd like me to cover and are like last week, let me know, that are relevant to this class, that is.